Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Owning It, the Anxiety Podcast with me, Caroline Foran. This week, I am thrilled to be joined by author and my dear friend, Louise O'Neill. She's the author of 4 books, and most recently, she brought out The Surface Breaks, which is a feminist retelling of The Little Mermaid, which we all know and love from our childhood. Louise is just incredible. We have such an amazing conversation about anxiety and all the different ways it's manifested for her and everything that she does to this day to keep it in check. And she has so much wisdom and so many tips and so many really interesting ways of looking at things. And obviously I'm her pal, so I could have sat there all day. It's probably one of the longest podcasts I've done, so I'm not going to go into what we talk about because I'm going to leave that for you. But before I let you go, I just want to remind you that there's still tickets available to my publishing masterclass, which is on July 20th in the Alex Hotel. And Louise will actually be there with me. She's going to be my special guest, along with Holly White, who was a recent podcast guest. And also, something that's come to my attention is that people who find the podcast and love the podcast and message me to say they found it really helpful aren't necessarily aware that I have 2 books out that cover the topics that I'm discussing in the podcast in book form. So Owning It was my first book. It was all about managing anxiety, and when that came out, it went to number one straight away for 16 weeks here in Ireland, and is now available around the world in different countries. So if you are finding the podcast helpful, I'll put the link to the book in the little description. I think they do work really well together, to have the book to refer back to and the podcast to listen to. And the second book is called The Confidence Kit, and there are topics in that book that I'm going to go into a little bit more as time goes on in the podcast, and that's more about the fear of failure, imposter syndrome, why we feel fear. So lots of information in there in both books, and thank you so much for your feedback. As always, the reviews mean the world to me because it just bumps the podcast up on the list of charts so people can find it easier, and any feedback is so much appreciated. Thank you so much, and enjoy this episode with Louise O'Neill. I'm so happy to be joined by, actually this time, a friend, which is so lovely because it doesn't feel like a formal interview set up when we're just having a chat. Louise O'Neill, very, very successful author of, how many books is it now?
It's 4. I nearly have to count myself. I'm like, how many? It's 4. Yeah.
One of the first things I wanted to ask you was something that comes up in like every interview I've done, and I've done so many of them now for this, is social media and that being such a huge driver of anxiety. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's like I'm in a bad marriage with it or something. Yeah. It's like I it's security and I need it, and it's where my work is, but it makes me feel like shit. Mm. And like, love-hate relationships. Sometimes it's good because I can put out my podcast and connect people straight away, and other times I'm scrolling and feeling like crap.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming, because you're not on social media anymore. Mm. You're on Twitter, aren't you?
I still have my author Facebook page, and the reason why I kept that is because I have zero interest in Facebook.
Yeah.
So I have no, do you know that kind of,
have it on
throw
my phone.
Something up on it.
Yeah.
And I won't think about it, and then like, you know, I won't look to see how many likes it's had. I won't look to see what the comments are like. I don't really care. I just don't seem to care as much about it. Whereas with Twitter and Instagram, which I came off, I'm a year off it now.
And I thought, because you were only going to go off them for a while.
Yes.
While you were writing.
I was just going to kind of see. And then I suppose the longer I stayed off it, the less I wanted to go back on. You know, it was funny, before this, I used to do, every month, I would go to like a nice hotel somewhere in Cork or Kerry, like somewhere not too far away from me. And I would take a 24-hour detox from my phone. Like, I would leave my phone in the car. So, you know, I wouldn't even look at it. I wouldn't have it anywhere near me. And then when I was coming back in the car on the way back to Clonakilty, and I turned on my phone, I could just feel the anxiety begin to creep up, you know, like I could just feel it in my stomach and then sort of like rising up my throat nearly. And it just was this feeling of complete fear of what email is going to come in, what has someone said, you know, I posted that yesterday, you know, what if that has ruined my career in a, you know, that's, I'm not sure if you've read So You've Been Publicly Shamed, you know.
Yes, like, yeah, I listened to the audiobook.
Yeah, like, yeah. Justine Sacco, you know, that you tweet something,
yeah. Yeah. Oh my God.
Before you get on a plane that, and then you get to
just listen
South
to that
Africa
gave me so much anxiety.
Fingers.
Yeah.
You know, it's that thing of turning on your phone and someone going, yeah, have you seen the news?
I know, and you're public enemy number one.
Yeah, like, and I'm like, it's so irrational because I'm like, I would never have said anything. Well, you would hope not, that would be misconstrued as racist or sexist or, you know, offensive in that way, because you would hope that you would try and be careful about what you're putting out into the world and what you're articulating. But I also think there's such an interesting conversation, I suppose, to be had around cancel culture, you know, which is something that I think we're really struggling with at the moment. And it's trying to, I think, really look at it in a nuanced way and say that it's really important that we're having these conversations. It's really important that people are being held to task. It's really important that people say, no, it's not acceptable if you use this sort of language, if you're transphobic, if you're homophobic, if you're using racist language. But then also, these are still human beings. Like, there has to be a way of
human error.
Of holding people accountable for their mistakes. And that's important, because I think too long, particularly white straight men, have sort of been allowed to get away with this. And, you know, you have to be held accountable for your behaviour. Mm-hmm. But there also has to be a way, I suppose, of rehabilitating people. Like, I want to believe in the power of change.
Yeah, and that there's no real room for that at the moment, is there? It's like, if someone makes a mistake, or, I mean, even just how things, we're going off topic here, but even, you know, I heard a phrase about how, can you hold the moral standards of today up to something that happened 30 years ago and put the same logic on and say, well, they said this terrible thing 30 years ago, when maybe 10 years ago, we were all saying different things that were socially acceptable at the time.
100%. And I know and I think that actually causes quite a lot of anxiety as well, is this fear of, will I be cancelled, you know? And
cancelled, is it a cancelled culture?
Yeah, you know, and I think it's, because sometimes with Facebook, you know, it's like on this day and it'll come up things that I wrote in 2008. I'm like, Jesus.
I know.
And like, it's not offensive. Like, you know, I wasn't, as you said, I wasn't being racist or I wasn't using that kind of, but it's just, it feels really outdated. It feels like ignorant. It feels like a lack of, I'm like, oh, I would never say that now. Or I look at articles even that I read, or that I wrote in 2014, that now I think, oh, I don't think that way anymore.
But that's just like growing up and changing, and
you have to have space for that. I think that contributes to a lot of the anxiety. And for me, I think with social media, the reason why I quit was because I am someone, I'm quite competitive. I've always, you know, I recently was playing a game of Guess Who with my best friend's 4-year-old daughter. And when we played 5 games, and she actually turned to me and she said, would you just let her win one?
Oh.
You know, and, like, and her husband was like, wow, you're really not taking it easy on our 4-year-old. Like, I was like, no, I have to.
Yeah,
and, okay, I have to take a step back here. So I think there's a part of me, and I try and sort of challenge that, because I think that being competitive can be helpful in certain ways. You know, if you're competitive with yourself and, you know, you're trying to, I don't know, create good work and you're trying to improve and you're trying to push yourself. But I think the problem is sometimes is that kind of can give way to comparison.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's that thing of, oh, you know, to compare is to despair.
Yeah.
And I think with social media, it got to a point where if I was feeling really great about something that had happened to me, and then I would go on social media and I would see something that was happening for someone else,
you feel like their success is taken from yours.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous. It's so weird, because it's like we live in this infinite world.
I know.
You know, there's so much opportunity. There's so many, there's so many, I think, chances, and there's so much abundance, and there's so much out there for all of us. But I really started to feel like as if I wasn't doing enough. I wasn't good enough. I wasn't working hard enough. I wasn't achieving enough. I wasn't far enough in my career. And I think for me, because I'm a real perfectionist as well, and that's something that, you know, I work with all the time, and I try and, you know, improve, you know, not improve, but I try and challenge, and I try not to let that take over. But it's really undercut by this feeling of I'm not good enough, which I think is sort of the crux of the human condition.
Yeah.
And with social media, it just every day just felt like I'm not good enough.
And do you feel, I guess you're way ahead of me in terms of books and stuff, but I feel like I can't not be on it because that's my promotional tool. But do you get anxiety because you're not on it because you can't be there promoting and keeping a narrative going?
I think it's, well, firstly, I we won't get into like,
oh yeah, sorry, know, like I'm after comparing us.
Like, yeah. Like, no, well, you're here and I'm here. Yeah. And it's like, no, I think, see, it's different with you because I think that like, with your podcast and with the way that your career has been set up, and you know that I think you do have
it's about me.
You, yeah, and yeah. I hate to use the word influencer because I feel like that's sort of become nearly like a dirty word at the moment,
yeah.
You know, but I think there's something really important about the way that you've harnessed social media for your message. And I think to a certain point I was also doing that because what I was talking about in social media was much bigger than me.
Yeah.
But I also think I don't know if social media sells books, and I'm talking about fiction anyway. You know, I know that, like, I remember going to Kerry with a friend of mine, Jessie Burton. You know, she's a novelist, and she sold millions of copies. And there was, I think it was recognized around two or three times while we were there, and she was really funny because she was like, "Oh my god, this is really interesting." She said, "This doesn't normally happen with authors." And a part of me felt, I suppose, that there was the exposure and there was the having your face being recognised and being an accidental kind of activist or spokesperson, and then feeling that, well, actually, I would much rather have a quieter life in certain ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's not on Twitter and I think she's on Instagram, but she doesn't have like hundreds of thousands of followers. And it's like, does it sell books?
Yeah.
You know, and if it's having... And if you enjoy it and you're, you know, you feel the benefit of having that ability to communicate with people and you feel that sense of community, then, you know, go for it. Mm-hmm. But if it's really taking a toll on your mental well-being and you don't enjoy it, then it's like, does it sell books?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Yeah. I honestly, I don't know. I would love to see.
I guess it depends on the nature of what you're selling, like you say. And when you get to a point where you're established as an author and not as just a social media person,
yeah,
that obviously helps as well. But I'm curious about, were you very quickly noticing the difference in your anxiety from being on it to being off it? Like, how would you compare the two? Really?
Yeah.
And tell me, what does it feel like when you when you let go?
It just, well, firstly, it felt like as if I'd been holding my breath for a year and then all of a sudden I was able to exhale. And I think that's the best. There was a tightness in my chest that felt like that was kind of loosening. And I think as well, I just cared less. Because I think when you're on it, particularly I suppose as, you know, the more people that follow you or the more people that, you know, that you're interacting with on a daily basis, you start hearing a lot of opinions. And there was a lot of other voices in my head and a lot of people telling me what they thought of me, how they felt about me, what they, you know, thought of my work and things like that. And sometimes it was good and sometimes it was really, really, really vile. And I remember my dad saying to me, because, you know, he used to play football when he was younger, and he said he stopped reading the papers after a match. And he said, because if I believed the good, then I'd have to believe the bad. And he said, it didn't matter because it didn't affect, like, the match was played. Do you know, he said there was no way of going back and changing the way that he had performed in that match. So he's like, what was the point of torturing himself? And he kept saying that to me. He was like, just don't read any of it. And that's fine because, you know, I don't read Goodreads reviews. I don't read Amazon reviews. But if someone asks you in a tweet or on Instagram, it's just straight in your face.
Yeah.
And I started, I think, you know, you become very aware of how you're being seen and how you're being viewed. And that made me feel really self-conscious. And I think that once I came off it, it was this feeling of actually, the only people that I really need to worry about is how I feel about myself, how my boyfriend feels about me, how my family feels about me, and how my friends feel about me. And all of a sudden, it felt like my world had become smaller in a way that felt safer and it felt more manageable.
Oh my God, it just sounds like the dream. What are we all doing? Yeah. It's crazy.
It's really hard because social media was really beneficial for my career. When I first started off and I was in West Cork and I didn't know anybody, I didn't know anyone in the publishing industry, you know, I was able to kind of create these relationships through social media that really helped.
That's how we got to know each other.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and like, I know even editors of magazines in the UK and that I was able to DM them and say, look, I know you get millions of proofs, but like mine will be coming in. Is there, you know, and you'd hope that maybe it might make them decide to pick it up and read it. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to give it a good review or feature it, but I would never have had that ability to reach those people living in a small town in Ireland if I hadn't had social media. And it also really informed my sense of feminism, my sense of sort of my politics, my sense of myself in that way. So I think that it's been really useful and beneficial, particularly for women and other people who've been marginalized by traditional media. It has, I think, given them space in order to have their voices be heard in a way that maybe traditional media didn't. But I also think it's like this giant thought experiment and we're the guinea pigs. And if you look at, like, in Silicon Valley, you know, when people talk about that, like, their children are not allowed to have phones, their children are not allowed to have social media accounts, because the people who are closest to this, I think, can see how addictive it is and how damaging it can be. Because if you're using it, that's fine. But if it's beginning to control you and if it's beginning to use you, I think that's where the problem, those were the problems
and
begin.
Did things like your sleep improve?
Yes. Well, I mean, I've always had issues with my sleeping. I went through a phase of just, I'd wake up every kind of at 2 a.m. and not be able to get back to sleep. And I've suffered with insomnia. I do transcendental meditation. This has been a recent thing that has been transformative, and I also take CBD oil, and that's also been really helpful.
So people keep asking me about CBD oil and I haven't tried it, so I can't say anything, but what do you do with it?
It tastes like an ashtray.
Okay.
Like, so you spray it underneath your tongue at like three times a day and you kind of hold it for like 90 seconds and then it's real. Like, my boyfriend gets really annoyed whenever I do. He's like, ugh, can you brush your teeth? Come near me. I can smell it from across the room. And it's just been...
Like, it's for anxiety.
Yes, it is for anxiety. And I have found, I suppose because it's sort of correlated with the time of doing the transcendental meditation as well. So I think the two in hand. Yeah. But I found it really helpful for sleeping. And that I all of a sudden was sleeping 8 hours. Wow. Which before I would wake a lot. You know, I'd get up and then I'd try and go back to sleep, and I find that really, really, really useful.
Yeah, it's probably a bit of that and a bit of obviously having the headspace from technology and all those things.
There is no one silver bullet. And I think that's the thing, is that it is a multi sort of disciplinary plan that you have to take.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there's loads of things, you know, like I started exercising more. Really try to eat really well and have a lot of sort of healthy carbohydrates and things like that in my diet. I try to, you know, spend less time on my phone, turn my phone off at 8 o'clock every evening, not look at it when I get up in the morning.
You're obviously very disciplined. I guess as being a writer and having to get into that headspace, you get used to putting these, disciplines on yourself where you say, you know, restrictions is what I'm looking for, where I feel like I'm trying to get there. I'm reading a book called Deep Work. Have you read it?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. Cal Newport.
Okay.
It is incredible. And it's all just systems and approaches to getting into a point where you're able to do deep work, which is the kind of work that you're doing, and get you away from the shallow work, which is the emails and the flitty bits and bobs, and how all of it, like our distraction and our focus and everything.
Yeah.
And he's just like, you have to be real badass with yourself about it. Like, you have to be like, the phone is staying over there.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, I can never just have my phone. Like yesterday, this is just an example. I was getting real fed up of Instagram. I was scrolling and I was like just seeing people, you know, posting their best bits and being like, meh, because I was having a bad day. And I was like, I'm going to delete Instagram. 10 minutes later, I was like, shit, I need to DM someone about something. I had to fucking download it again.
I see, that is the problem, yeah.
And then I felt like this complete, like, slave control thing. It was awful.
I think it is about trying to, as you said, trying to be really disciplined. And, like, it's easy. Well, not easy, no, because it's really hard. And I still find it really hard. And I think I have made myself become, in lots of ways, I think I have made myself be someone that I'm not naturally. And I'm going to, like, I remember when I was working at Elle in New York, I was like, I'm really struggling with this, but I'm not naturally someone who's very organized. I'm not naturally someone who's very, you know, my boss was like lists and folders, yeah. And, you know, like, really just, my sister actually, who's a primary school teacher, would have actually been much, and has no interest in fashion, would have been much better suited to that job, because she is someone who is just quite a type A personality and, like, really just perfectionistic about, you know, everything being perfectly organized. But I think I actually made myself, in the same way that I used to sleep till like noon when I was well into my 20s, and then I made myself into a morning person.
Wow.
So I think there's been, and people say, oh, you're really organized, and I always have my lists, and I say actually it's because I'm not naturally an organized person, or because I'm not actually naturally a disciplined person. I have to be a little bit stricter with myself, and I suppose because I see what happens when I'm not disciplined, when I see when I'm not meditating, when I'm not exercising, when I'm not you know, spending less time on my phone, I see the impact that has on me. You know, I see the anxiety begins to rise. My eating habits can get a little bit funny. You know, I just don't feel as well in myself. So maybe because of having had a mental health issues, I have to be disciplined. Maybe if I could, you know, scroll all day on Instagram, and if I could eat a lot of junk food, and if I didn't ever exercise, and it had no real impact, then maybe I wouldn't.
Yeah,
I'd be like, exactly. Sure, yeah. It doesn't affect me. Whereas I can see things sliding if I don't.
Yeah. So talk to me about anxiety then. Is it something that's always been in your life?
Well, you know what's really funny, Caroline, and I was chatting to a friend of mine who has an anxiety disorder. I have two very close friends who have anxiety disorders, and I was talking to one of them, and I said to her, you know, I said, I never thought that I had anxiety. And it was, you know, I'm 2 years properly in recovery now, because I had a relapse in 2016, and I'm sort of, it'll be 2 years in June. And it was only when I went back into recovery that I realized that I actually was incredibly anxious, but that I had been using the eating disorder as a way of managing it. So I thought I was very calm. I thought I was one of the most chilled out people. Nothing ever really got to me. I was just so like, it'll be fine. Because anything that happened stressful that would bring up anxiety, I would use, you know, either I would skip a meal, or I would make myself get sick, or I would do something like that that actually took the anxiety.
You were channeling it into that.
And in a way, it's just, that's why people have addictions.
Yeah.
Because in some, it does actually serve like a really fucked up and dysfunctional function, but it does serve that. So when I stopped doing that, it was really overwhelming, because it all came up.
Because then you have to confront the reality.
Absolutely. Where I just felt like, oh my God, I'm so anxious. I just feel constantly really uneasy. I just feel really afraid. I am really worried about my career, you know, and I have been someone who'd all, and actually it's coming back now. It's only now I think that I'm really feeling that sort of positive expectation around my life coming back. But I just felt so overwhelmed by it.
And was it a lot of it career related?
It was everything. It was literally, I mean, I suppose a lot of it probably, you know, I think a great deal of it was career related, but I suppose it also coincided with the time where I had written Asking For It. I'd written the first draft of Asking For It before Only Ever Yours came out. So Almost Love was the first novel that I was releasing that was coming out after being published.
Okay.
And following up Asking For It was never going to be an easy proposition anyway. So from the moment I started writing, I felt in a constant state of fear and anxiety. Just this awful, just sense of,
how are you going to strike lightning twice?
You know, and people want asking, they're going to want asking for a part two. And I don't, as a creative person, as an artist, I don't want to do that. And I think there was just a lot of a fear around that. So it was just really interesting, I think, to see the fact that I'd always seen myself as a very chilled out. I didn't let things get to me. I didn't let things bother me.
So interesting.
And then go, oh no, 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 no. It was just all being channeled over here. And now that I'm coming back into my own body, and now that I'm really feeling my feelings, and now that I'm really connecting with myself again, I was like, I have this deep well of anxiety, you know.
In a way, did that help you make sense of the eating disorder, though? That it was like,
yeah,
well, if I know that it's anxiety that I'm putting in this box, maybe I can decide not to put it in that box.
100%.
Even though it's going to be so difficult to deal with the reality of the anxiety,
yeah,
it's going to be easier than
It is. The other thing. You know what the thing is? Is that it was really hard and it was really horrible. But I was like, I would rather have this anxiety and deal with it in a way that is healthy and sustainable. Because, yeah, you know, I'm life affirming.
And that kind of anxiety won't kill you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because I think, you know, it came to a point where I was like, well, I can manage this. I can manage this with, as I said, you know, meditation, eating well, exercising. And, you know, I'm lucky that I don't need to take... Well, no, lucky is the wrong word. Because I think, you know, I get really annoyed when I hear people talk about, you know, medication, and, you know, sort of, oh, you know, you can, it's just a vitamin, you know, it's very Scientology language, this kind of idea of it's just a vitamin deficiency. Yeah. And I suppose that I felt that in some ways that I was, you know, that I could manage mine through these other kind of techniques, but like, there's lots of people who do just need medication, and it's really brilliant that it's there.
Yeah.
Isn't it incredible that...
Oh, like, thank, you know, God.
Absolutely.
Like, I absolutely needed it.
Yeah.
But it was, like, and I've said so many times when we did a special on medication, it wasn't just like, oh, I couldn't be arsed dealing with it, so I'm going to take medication. It was, I needed to get my head, I was down here under the table, I needed to get my head above here so that I could benefit then from the sleep rituals, the going for the walks and stuff, because I was so physically, hormonally... out of whack.
100%.
But not everyone will need to do it. And if you do need to do it, it doesn't mean that you're in such a desperate state.
Yeah.
It can just be correcting a problem.
You know what? The analogy that I would use is that when I first went into hospital, when I was hospitalized with anorexia when I was 21, and it was John of God's, and they said that, you know, we have to refeed you. Like, you know, because you can't, you're not, when you're really underweight and when you're starving yourself, you're not cognitively able to go to therapy and, you know, undertake this. Like, we need you to get to this level in order that you can absorb any of the messages that we're trying to
give
you.
You need to get back to basics 100%.
So when you're when you're in that level, when you're very depressed or when you're very anxious or when you're very underweight, like, it's someone saying to you, just get out for a walk. You may as well just tell me to go climb Everest.
I know, it's fuck off. Like, if I knew that was going to make a difference, I would have done it by now.
Yeah, and that's, I think those kind of things are in the sustainable, like, how do I sustain this? What's my maintenance plan? Mm. And that was the same with the eating. They're like, well, we're going to refeed you. And then when you get, and so you'll be eating more. And then when you get to this level, then it'll be maintenance.
Mm.
And it's like, so when you get to like an equilibrium, how do you maintain this? And then the exercise comes into play.
Exactly.
And then the sleeping
and I think that's the best way to approach it. I want to ask you then, if the eating disorder could link back to anxiety, and you know that that's why that's happening, what does the anxiety link back to?
Like, in my own life?
Yeah, do you think it's just anxiety that is your personality and your nature and you're predisposed to it? Or
I definitely think there's definitely that I am predisposed. I think there is an element of that.
People who are creative tend to be.
Well, I would, I can understand that. And I think with me, though, I was really afraid of getting things wrong. I wanted everything to be perfect. I wanted, you know, I was really afraid of making a mistake. So I think there was this anxiety always of, you know, I use this, I was telling someone recently about when I was in college, and, you know, when you play drinking games, and if I was at a party and someone would say, oh, we're going to play this drinking game, and I didn't know how to play it, I wouldn't play it for the first time in front of other people in case I would get it wrong and they would think I was stupid. Like, I would nearly have to go practice the drinking game by myself in order to feel comfortable. So there was just this constant sort of anxiety of getting it wrong, making a mistake, not being perfect, making a fool of myself. So there was, that was kind of always there. And I think that I was just someone as well who always pretended everything was totally fine.
Were you trying to be someone that you weren't?
Constantly. And actually, one of the most interesting things about recovery is that I think beforehand I thought that I was going to turn into, like, it was going to be the St. Paul and the Road to Damascus kind of type of conversion. I was going to become someone who was just really zen and practiced yoga for 10 hours a day and, like, you know, didn't really, you know, care for technology, and, you know, I'll go back to, you know, the earth and I'll start gardening and I don't know, you know, like, just, and then actually what I think I've realized the true recovery is becoming more of who you are, not changing into someone else, just become
and accepting that maybe you're going to be an anxious person sometimes,
and that it's not I mean, everyone has shit, you know, and I think the great thing, I suppose, about living in the age that we do live in is that there is a growing understanding of mental health issues, and that most people, well, not most people, but like a huge majority of people will have a struggle with some sort of mental health issue at some period over their lifetime. And maybe that'll be because of something that's happened, you know, because of a bereavement or because of a loss in that way, or because it's just part of your personality, and that you learn to manage it in the same way that if you had diabetes or if you had something like that, that it just becomes a very small part of your life that you learn.
I remember I used to hear people describing someone as, oh, like, she's this person, whoever, oh, she's just so laid back, so chilled, and I used to just be so like, I want to be that way.
Yeah.
Or like as if that was the ultimate way to be and to live. And actually, while I'm laid back about a lot of things, like the big things in life, I can be quite like, yeah, okay, we'll deal with this. And it's the little things that I can be like, oh, but that's who I am, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean I can't be like successful, but or whatever.
It clearly doesn't, Caroline.
Yeah, but
and I think that's really great to know, though.
Yeah, to just accept yourself.
Yeah, and that's the goal.
Yeah. Did you find that writing, obviously, you were channeling so much of what you were experiencing into these characters, did that help you find your own voice, giving voices to the characters, like in The Surface Breaks?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously with The Surface Breaks, I suppose, you know, which is the retelling of The Little Mermaid, and like so much of that story, which is so fascinating looking at it now, because I love that story as a child, and it's looking back at it now as an adult, and you're like, my God, this is a story about a young woman who literally silences herself and gives up her voice and mutilates her body in order that a man that she barely knows will find her attractive. And I mean, I just, you know, because I think a lot of people say, oh, you know, political correctness gone wrong. But I think as a child, like, you absorb these, you're like a sponge.
100%.
You know, you're just absorbing these messages. And I think for me, I was like, what was I learning? Particularly as someone who did inflict harm upon my own body in order to be more attractive or to be more acceptable. And I think when I was writing that book, I really wanted to, I think, reclaim that narrative and really highlight how problematic and dangerous a lot of the messages in it were. And I think really to reinforce this idea that, particularly for women, because, you know, they, like, anxiety is so much higher in women. Like, I think it affects both genders, but, you know, it is, because I think there's just this weight of expectation on women as well. And, you know, so often we are told, I think, that what society wants from us is to look pretty and to sort of stay quiet. You know, like the appeal of Kate Moss for years was that, you know, that she just never talked. And I think there's something so
messed up,
isn't there?
Yeah.
And I suppose I just really wanted to kind of look at that with The Surface Breaks. And just, I know that, when I think for me, finding my own voice and using that and speaking up and speaking out was that I realized that even though that did make me feel uncomfortable at times, and even though that did make me feel anxious at times, it was better than when I didn't. When I would go home after a party where someone had made a comment that was, you know, offensive or like really hurtful, and I didn't say anything. And I would go home and I would really internalize that, and I would feel so terrible about myself. And I'd be like, and I would berate myself, I'd be like, for why didn't you stand up for yourself? Why didn't you say this? You know, you're pathetic and you're this. And it just made me feel so much worse, and it made me feel so much more anxious than actually that moment of just saying, that's not okay, or I don't feel comfortable with you saying that. And then, you know, you don't have to make a big fuss about it. It's literally just using your voice.
And you also use your voice for yourself in a very empowering decision to stop drinking. Is that something that you
how long has it been now? It's been 2 years in April. I did have a half of a glass of champagne the night of the premiere of the Asking for the play.
You probably didn't like it.
I know, it was really weird. It was, I took a taste, and I was like, oh, this is, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
It was funny. You know what happened was, I still remember the last time I drank, because it was this really, it was out in Dublin, actually, and I was out with friends, and we were all, I mean, they were in the horrors the next day as well, and I just made a really terrible decision, and I, involving an ex-boyfriend, which isn't always, and I woke up the next morning, and I just felt, I mean, talk about anxiety, it was just, it was so intense.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
And I just really, I think it was the hate, it was the self-loathing. It was that I do not want to be in my body. I just hated myself. Mm. And I just felt, I think that was April and I sort of went into proper recovery in the June of that year. So I think they were kind of tied up with each other. In that I really, whenever I was hungover, that I found it more difficult to make decisions that were, I suppose, beneficial for my mental health. And mm-hmm. I found it much easier to slip into eating disordered behaviours when I was feeling kind of vulnerable.
Yeah.
Which I always did when I was tired and hungover. And so it just became kind of tied up in that. And then I think I just fell out of the habit.
Yeah.
You know, and it's true. Like I have like three weddings coming up and they're the worst. Like those are the hardest.
So it's kind of in a way like you're helping your anxiety by taking away alcohol, but then there's the anxiety around society.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
people being, because it's still rare for an Irish person to, and I just read a statistic the other day that like, I think Irish women are like the fourth in the world for heaviest drinkers.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And I was like, what? Yeah, it's grim.
And that doesn't, it just doesn't help. Like, it, no. You know, and I don't want to sound, you know, I don't want to sound puritanical and I don't want to sound boring. Do you know? And I mean, I know that's a real Irish thing.
Then, yeah, it's the same.
But I think it's just when you're talking to people and you're like, oh, you know, I meditate and I try not to look. And it just makes me sound like I'm this really perfect little person. And I'm so far from that. And I think it's really, I don't want to sound like this sort of paragon of,
no,
you
but
know,
you don't. You just sound like, and that is another thing. It's like what you're saying there is clear to me, is that there's an anxiety around you wanting to do what you want to do when you want to do it and feeling like you shouldn't because of the way it looks or seems.
I know. No, you're right. And I'm trying to kind of get away from that. But I think it's, I suppose you don't want it to seem.
Do you care what people think?
I mean, okay, come on, Caroline. Like I was going to say, I've definitely gotten better. Mm. And I think coming off social media did help with that.
Yeah.
But like, it's never nice when, you know, we've talked about this, like I've had a couple of situations where people, you just know this person does not like you.
Yeah.
And you try and reason it and say, look, my face probably reminds them of someone that they knew in third class that they mm-hmm. didn't like. Or maybe, you know, I'm not for everybody. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't understand why. Know. But, you know, you just have to accept that. It's never nice.
No,
and
it's
I think
not.
Because it really triggers, I think, this part of in me that thinks, especially before I would very, particularly in relationships, I would very deliberately, if I was with someone and they were interested in me and it was a mutual thing, I would be like, oh, I've no time for this person. Kind of like Groucho Marx, you know, I don't want to be part of a club that would have me as a member, you know. And I really consciously, like the two people before my current relationship, which is really, really healthy and loving and, you know, mutually like very supportive and kind. Before that, there was two people that I kind of would have sort of deemed as the people that I was most, I would have said in love with, but now I would say infatuated with, you know.
Yeah.
And looking back, I can say, oh yeah, those were the two people who were completely emotionally unavailable, never gave me any like room to be myself, never gave me any, like, and to be fair to them, they never gave me any indication that they wanted any sort of real relationship either. But because they withheld their approval from me, they were the person that I wanted the approval from most in the world. And actually the reason behind it, Carolyn, was because I thought they know the real me. These people that like me and who want to be with me, they are fooled. Whereas this person who clearly doesn't think I'm good enough, they can see my insides. And if I can get this person to fall in love with me, maybe I am good enough. Mm. Maybe I can sort of accept that.
Yeah.
And actually with a fear of intimacy and a fear of being vulnerable as well, because subconsciously I knew that they would never be, I would never have to be vulnerable with me because they would never give me that space. Mm. And with Richard, when we first started dating, a lot of anxiety came up around the beginning and a lot of discomfort. And I had to sort of sit with this, that I actually feel more comfortable in a relationship where I'm being treated badly. And yeah, that was a really hard thing to kind of have to work through and sort of try and figure out where that came from.
And you have to allow him to love you.
Yeah.
And not,
yeah, oh, he's determined.
But you were probably looking for a way to show that he wasn't or something,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Like I felt when I was getting sort of serious with Barry is when I started to really experience anxiety, and we've talked about this, I had him on the podcast as well, and how I was like, you need to go and be free, like this is not fair for you, this is not what you signed up for, this is, you know, you thought you were getting the Instagram Caroline and now you're getting Caroline like with mascara on her face on the side before.
Still a babe.
And he was like, but I love you, I don't, I was like, no,
yeah,
you don't though, you don't, like you don't. And he's like, no, but I do, I want to be here. And I was like self-sabotaging, trying to,
yeah,
be like, you, I don't know, it's like I didn't deserve it or something. I don't deserve someone to love me
and
like
you,
that.
And the thing is, well, firstly, you do. Mm-hmm. And secondly, you know, if he was experiencing these issues, if he was going through something really difficult or traumatic or was having that kind of experience, you would want to be there for him.
Yeah.
Like if he turned to you and said, oh, you should leave, you know, you shouldn't be here for it, it would be so insulting,
yeah,
and hurtful, because you would think, how could you think that I wouldn't want to be here? Like, how could you think that?
Yeah.
But I think it's that sense of that you don't want to be a burden.
Exactly.
Do you know?
And that's such a thing for people with anxiety,
yeah,
is that they feel burdensome on almost everyone in their life.
Yeah.
It's so tough. When it comes to your anxiety day to day, what are your top things that you do? So the CBD?
Yes, the CBD oil is great. The Transcendental Meditation, which is a relatively new, like I've sort of been meditating on and off since I was, I did a course in Trinity when I was 18. And then I remember when I was in New York, I joined sort of like a Buddhist meditation group that I used to go to twice a week after my shifts. And it was good, whereas with this one, It's still early on, so I sort of feel like I don't want to give a very conclusive answer.
Because it sounds intimidating to me.
Well, I will say it's the easiest form of meditation I've ever done.
Okay.
It feels so effortless. Like when we first did it, I was like, this can't be.
What do you do
in
it?
Well, it's a bit like Fight Club. You're not really supposed to talk about it.
But
I'll tell you anyway. So you have to go and see someone. Like you can't kind of learn it by yourself. And so for 4 consecutive days, you go and you have an hour and a half meeting with a teacher, and they give you a mantra, and they teach you how to do it, and then you have to do it for 20 minutes twice a day. Now, when I've been doing other meditations, 5 minutes even a day, I'm like, oh, this is so boring.
Yeah.
I cannot do this. My brain, this is, I cannot explain how easy it is.
Okay.
And I know that sounds really weird because it's 20 minutes and it's longer, but it just feels, it feels very deep, very quickly. It feels really easy. It feels really effortless, which is the whole point of it. They're like, if you're
exerting effort, you're,
yeah,
you miss the
they're
point.
Like, you're getting it wrong. You know, there is no
or
right,
yeah,
but like, which I hate. But anyway, and I'm so used to really working really hard and making a huge effort that actually being told to do less was quite challenging.
So
like,
hard.
I need to get this right.
I
need to be the best meditator in the world.
And as well for people with anxiety, I had this conversation with Sheila Shoga about breathing as a way of, or meditating or anything where you just have to be still and be with yourself. It's like the opposite of what an anxious person wants. They want to get out of their head. It's scary to sit there with yourself. So that's the biggest challenge, isn't it?
Well, I think with this though, it's different because it's not mindfulness. And mindfulness I do try and practice during the day, which I know can be really difficult for people with anxiety because you don't want to be present. Mindfulness I find very useful to kind of give, it feels like it gives me more time. It feels as if I can, you know, I'm not constantly in my head thinking I'm rushed and I'm busy. So it's TM is very different to mindfulness. TM sort of feels like there's kind of a blissfulness to it. I know that sounds really weird. It's really enjoyable. Like, okay. I sit down and I go, I can't wait for this 20 minutes.
Really?
Yeah, it's really...
Do you come away? You obviously produce loads of lovely delta waves and all those
things.
Yeah,
like, it's a lot of serotonin and, you know, things like that. But it's very... I remember even with... Sorry, I'm going to be rambling about this because I suppose it's quite new to me. So I'm still, like, learning it. I'm not learning it, but still sort of experiencing it as a new thing. But with meditation... when I'm finished normally with normal meditation, I'm like, oh, I'm done, I'm ready to go. Whereas with TM, it actually takes me a few minutes to come out of it.
That's good.
It feels nearly like, I'm nearly like,
yeah.
Like, it's almost like a physical.
Like a drug feeling.
Yeah, honestly, I swear to God.
So do you do that twice a day?
Yeah.
Every day?
Yeah. And that has been, yeah, like yesterday now when I arrived here, I was so harried. I had to go to an event and I was meeting a friend and I had to do my makeup and I was feeling really bothered. So I was like, you can't do it at nighttime because it gives you a boost of energy. So you have to do it sort of in the, like it's in the morning when you first get up and then around 4 or 5 o'clock or you know, 6, yeah. whenever you kind of come back from work to give you a bit of energy for the rest of the evening. So I did it. And then when I was finished, I just felt like, oh my God, I feel amazing.
Wow.
So I really, I mean, look, as I said, I don't want to give, and I think.
But you've just found what works for you.
100%. And I also think a big thing that I try and say to people is, I don't really believe in one thing fits all.
No.
You know, you meet people who are vegans or you meet people who are paleo and all they eat is meat and they're like, this is the only way. And I said, actually, no, everyone's different. Everyone's body is different. Everyone's experience is different. Everyone's like schedule and lifestyle is different. And it's kind of trial and error. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to sort of look around and you go, oh, like for a while, I found yoga incredibly beneficial. I did yoga twice. Like I went to a yoga class twice a week for... I got around 5 years and that was amazing. And then it turned into a point where I was like, actually, I need to sweat more. So now I go to like a weights class and I do that 3 times a week and then I swim and it changes.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
And I think it's really about trying to listen to yourself. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that we're so used to silencing ourselves and silencing our needs and silencing our urges and silencing our appetites and trying to control what we eat and what we, you know, that we don't actually sit with ourselves and say, what does my body need? What does my body need right now? Yeah. You know?
My mom always said to me, and it stuck with me forever, is obey your body.
Yeah.
So
that's a really good advice.
And I feel like I have I feel like something good that my anxiety has given me is a very sharp awareness between my mind and my body. And whereas before, I think my body would have been working independently of my mind. So, you know, my body would be showing me anxiety before my mind realized I was dealing with something.
Yeah.
Whereas now they're so much more aligned. And if my body feels like, I know people say like you'll never regret a workout, you know, doing it, but sometimes my body is like, no, like I just need to lie in the bed and breathe,
and there's nothing wrong with
that. And like the worst thing you can do then is berate yourself for not doing it.
And
so,
see, this is the problem, I think, is that we're so hard on ourselves. Yeah. And like, you know, I read a very good book. It was called Kindfulness. And it was about self-compassion. And I think that's one of the hardest things, because we've been taught about the importance of self-esteem, but self-esteem is so directly linked to achievement and outside external forces, which actually you have no control over.
Exactly.
And it's self-compassion is, well, even if I fail, and even if this all goes wrong, or, you know, if I write a book and it's critically panned, can I still love myself? Can I still be kind to myself? And, you know, like, I feel like, you know, we're talking about this here, and I suppose, you know, people might listen and say, oh wow, she sounds like she's got it all together. And it's like, well, I'm actually having a really good month. And then I could have a week where things feel awful.
But you're a human being.
And I think that is part of it as well, is...
You're gonna react badly to something, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But over time, it's not like a direct path up to like perfection. It's like you learn, you have 2 steps forward, 1 step back.
100%.
Or else, you know, actually, I've been in this situation before. I know how better to react to this. And that just comes with experience and like diving inwards to yourself and all the efforts that you're making as well.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, I remember reading both of your books and thinking this is such a great little toolkit. You know, that there's like tips and there's just little, you know, that if you're stuck and you're like, well, here is a method or an idea or a little resource that you can use.
Mm-hmm.
Try this, not trick is the wrong word, but, you know, like try this idea. And the more that you have of those, I think, resources in your arsenal, the more able that you are to cope with things. And also, not that you're not going to make mistakes or not that you're going to react badly, but sometimes to bounce back quicker.
That's it.
Do you know?
That's the point I was trying to get at.
Yeah. Meltdown. But that doesn't turn into... Because sometimes I think my life can feel like dominoes. That, it, you know, when it's going well, it kind of continues to go well. And then when it goes badly, that sometimes that feels like that can kind of spiral as well.
Yeah.
But it's trying to be able to catch,
yes,
you know, and to be able to bounce back and go, okay, I had a bad day. I'm not going to let a bad day turn into a bad week or a bad month. You know?
Or like I still, I mean, I've said this a lot of times, but I felt like a lot of pressure and anxiety when the book came out that people were going to assume that I was like, had it figured out and cured. And I'm obviously always stressing the importance of, it's not about that at all.
Yeah.
But when I do feel anxiety, like I tend not to feel anxiety as much because I don't mind when it comes, because I know when it comes, I'll bounce back from it. I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Whereas the first time I think it feels like, it's like a, you get my life now, you know?
You feel like this is my life. I'm never going to be any different.
Yeah.
And do you still do therapy?
Oh, yeah. I try and go every 2 weeks. Sometimes if I'm having very bad body image and kind of, you know, if I'm going through a phase where I'm really struggling with that, it's up to a week, once a week. And the thing is I do a lot of, like, you know when you were learning piano, right? Well, I'm not sure if
I did piano.
Yeah. Sorry, that was such a middle class presumption. You know when we were learning piano?
Oh, I actually did.
But, sorry, when I was learning piano, like, I was terrible for practicing. So I'd go in once a week and, like, you know, we'd be doing the scales and then she'd go home and practice. You cannot go to your piano lesson once a week or to your therapy session once a week and think, that's like going to the gym once a month and thinking that you're going to get fit. Like, it has to be, you have to. When I read a lot of self-help books.
Mm-hmm.
I journal. I'm so sorry. I know I'm making this sound really boring and another full-time job. But I think it's that kind of, it's consistency.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be like, you know, I read whatever self-help book that I'm doing at the moment. I read it for maybe half an hour or an hour before I go to bed.
Okay.
I don't like to read fiction before I go to bed because I have really strange dreams. So I like that kind of, that sort of positive material to be going in, and I'll do a little bit of like writing exercises. So it's not that, you know, you don't have to spend hours on it, you know, every day.
What's the biggest thing you've learned from going to therapy and having someone reflect your reality back
to
you?
Oh God, I think the biggest thing, which I'm still learning, is self-compassion.
It's the hardest thing.
It's just still learning that I suppose that I'm deserving of love just by mere kind of virtue of being alive.
Yeah.
That I don't have to do anything to make myself worthy of being loved or being lovable. And I think that that has to really start with myself, because I hope, you know, that I'm a good friend and that I'm compassionate to people and that, you know, people can come to me and tell me things, and I really try not to judge, and I'm pretty unshackled.
Well, I can attest to that.
Oh, thank you, Caroline. And I think it would just be nice sometimes that I'm understanding of other people's flaws and frailties, and you know, that I'm very understanding of other people's mistakes, but then when I hold myself up to a completely different standard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just trying to constantly challenge that and say, you know, it's okay. I wish someone had maybe sat with me when I was a child and said, it's okay to make this mistake. It's okay to fail at this. It's okay to get this wrong. You can try again.
Yeah.
This will not be.
But you would have been
rewarded
for things working out. And then you straight away as a kid link that with approval.
100%. And I suppose I was probably, you know, I was good in school and there was things like that. And I suppose as well, you know, like my dad would have been a really, like, you know, he would have been someone who, and he didn't, he was really kind to us, and he never sort of put any of that, but I think as a child you absorb it. He would have been very hard on himself. I think he would have had he's a Virgo. I think he would have had very high standards for himself, and he would have been a real perfectionist. And myself and my sister, both, my mother is the most, I mean, honestly, I really wish we had taken after her. She is the most relaxed person. Like, we were at a gym class recently, she came with me, and I started to feel kind of sick midway through it, and I said, oh, I feel really sick. And she went, well, we go home. And she was so eager, she nearly was like one foot out the door. It would never have occurred to me that I could go. And like, if that had been my dad or my sister there, they would have said, push through it.
Yeah.
Do you know that kind of like, just push through it, just keep going through it. You know,
you
are in control of that.
You see going
home
as being a quitter.
Yeah, as failing, as, you know, as, whereas she was like, well, you're not feeling well, what's the point?
But there's like, quitting when you don't want to quit would be, I guess, quitting. Quitting when something is no longer serving you is self-compassion.
100%. And I think that that's been, that's been such a learning experience for me, you know.
And separate to career achievements, because I think we all in society tend to focus so much on that, with you and your journey, I hate that word, but
yeah,
it's been one. What are you most proud of with yourself?
That's really interesting. You know what? And it's funny. I remember last year when I had my first year kind of anniversary of really being properly. And actually, I would have said, like I said, I had a relapse in 2016. I think I had sort of accepted that I was going to be someone who was going to be 80% recovered. Mm-hmm. That I would go 4 months, you know, very well, and then have a month of really like, you know, a lot of vomiting or a lot of kind of restriction, or, you know, like a, you know, that the eating would go off kilter and then I would get back on track. Mm-hmm. So I had accepted that I was only ever going to be, you know, as I said, 80%. So I think in the last 2 years of being like, fully recovered, like I've been very healthy. I remember last year in June, and I had the first year anniversary, and I said it to my parents. I said, oh, you know, it's 1 year. And they were so thrilled. And my dad said to me, he said, this is the most proud. He said, this is the thing. He said, any of the other stuff, he said, that's lovely. He said, but this is the thing I'm most proud of. And it reminded me of when I got my Leaving Cert results, because I was in Spain at the time and my dad went to collect them. And I'd done really, like really well in my exams. And I think I came like second in my year. Like, you know, I'd done really well, but I had, I can barely remember now, but however many honours subjects, and maths was my past subject because I was really weak at maths. And he rang and he said, which still makes me laugh because it was such a poor result, but anyway, he went to Louise, I'm so proud of you. You got a C in past maths. And I was like, just tell me what I fucking got in the rest of it. And then that was because all of the rest of it came so easy to me that he was like, oh yeah, grand. But it was the fact, I think, that he was like, he knew I had really had to work for that C in past maths. Like I really had to sort of like struggle for that. So I think he was like, this is really meaningful. Mm. So for me, I think actually people talk about success and they say, how has that changed your life? And I'm like, well, you know, it's changed certain things. It's nice to have money. It's not, you know, there's things like I was very broke until I was 30 and the first two books sold for €15,000. So like I got, you know, it was like €7,500 for a year, you know, so that was, you know, so it's not exactly, you know, I was living at home with my parents because I couldn't afford to live anywhere else. So things like that have been really nice. But actually, the thing that has had the biggest impact on my day-to-day life, like that hasn't, because I still live at Clonakilty. I still like get up and I go to my desk and I still feel like exactly the same. The thing that has had the biggest impact on my day-to-day life has been recovery, has been, I think, really putting my mental health as my priority. Because I think what was really interesting after asking for it was that I actually began to realise when I'd had a very major relapse after that, I think I was beginning to realise that I had started to carve out an identity for myself based upon my success. Because I didn't know who I didn't have any other real sense of identity. And there was a part of me that felt very, very connected with that if I went to a dinner or if I met someone new, that it gave me a sense of confidence that I could go, well, I'm an author and you know, I've had this certain amount of success. And it was so false. It was exactly the same way that I felt a sense of pride in having a certain number on the weighing scales or wearing clothes that were a certain, you know, that I would also derive a sense of pleasure and a sense of self-worth and a sense of self-esteem from that as well. And that I realized, I was like, I can't, because these are so easily taken away from me. Mm-hmm. You know, like a book will come out and some people will like it and some people won't. You know, one book will do better than the other. Mm-hmm. Your weight will fluctuate. And it has to be so firmly rooted in myself. And that's something that I do every day. And that's, I think, will be my life's work, is coming back to myself. You know, starting to identify with success, or starting to identify with the way I look, or starting to, and then no, back to myself.
And do you have a mantra that you tell yourself every day, or an affirmation?
You know, not really. Like, actually, that's not true. I do have a few things, and it's funny because the reason why I said not really was because I felt a little bit embarrassed.
You don't have to share it.
No, I think it's because they sound really religious. And I'm not religious. I think I've been quite outspoken about how I feel about the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
But I'm so spiritual. And I think that actually one of the probably part of the anxiety and the eating disorder, I suppose, with any sort of addiction, it's like this search for a higher meaning and a search for, I think, a sense of connection. So for me, a lot of it is connected to a greater power, a higher power, something greater than I am, and asking that higher power to use me for the greater good. Mm. You know, it's that thing of, you know, make me a channel for your peace. And I know that's how, like, I know people are like, oh my God, she's a real, you know, like a born again Christian or something. And
she's here in her robes.
Yeah. So I suppose that's what I just try and, you know, what do you want me to do today? Where do you want me to go? Who would you have me see? And what would you have me say to them? Mm. And there's a sense of, I think, that connection that it feels really profound to me. God, I'm, you know, if I was listening to this, I'd be like, she is some dope. I swear, I'm not like this. I suppose it's the, but when I, this is probably.
But I'm asking you these questions about, you know, about how you look after yourself.
It's so self-important. No, make me a channel of your peace, God.
But right, I'm going to stop you there because, like, oh, she's very self-important. Yeah, we fucking should be self-important. Why? I mean, no, but like, self-importance doesn't have to mean you don't care about anyone else. But yeah, you should, like, we should be putting ourselves and our needs.
No, you're right.
Up there,
you're
right. We have this messed up perception.
You're totally right, and we need to prioritize. And you know, it's that that cliche used time and time again. You know, when there's an emergency and they say, put on your mask before you attend to anyone else because you can't.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah.
Like, and I think, you know, it's. It's just trying to, I think, be in your best, to not idea of like be your best self, which is so obnoxious, but like to try and be, and not to be someone else's idea of what your best self looks like, to actually be someone that you feel comfortable with.
Just to be yourself.
100%. And whatever that looks like.
Yeah.
And I think that if we could learn that, like, from really early on, that you don't have to please other people, which is something we've talked about, you know, the kind of people pleasing thing, which just is a weight and a burden, I think, that it particularly is placed on women. And just to try and let that go and just say, look, I can only be myself. Mm-hmm. And some people will like me and some people won't. And I'm still learning to try and be okay with that, you know?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's an ongoing learning. Before I let you go, I suppose just a question for the fangirl in me and for everyone else who'll be listening. Of all the female characters that you've written, who would you most identify with?
Oh God. Probably, you know what's really funny, because she was the one that everyone hated the most, was probably Sarah in Almost Love.
Oh yeah.
Which is so funny because I remember it not now, but definitely when I was younger, when I was in my early 20s, I was so there was so much self-loathing and there was so much anger and there was so much frustration in me, and I think that I had so much like unexpressed fury nearly, and I didn't know how to give voice to that, and I could really lash out at people who were closest to me. And it was only really when I began like to really recover and to get into therapy and to start taking care of myself that all of that kind of dissipated. So I could really identify with, I think, when you're damaged, which I was, you know, when I was particularly, I think, at 19 or 20, which I was doing an event last night with a French author, and we were talking about sexual violence, and she said it's like poison. She was raped when she was nine. Her name is Adelaide Bond, and she was raped when she was nine, and she said, you don't understand the impact that it has. It kind of spreads around the rest of your life. And when I was sexually assaulted when I was 19, I sort of put it in the box and said, I'm not going to think about that, which is how I dealt with anything that was sort of mental, like what I was saying earlier with anxiety. Put it in the box, never think about it again. So when that happened, and afterwards, I just couldn't figure out. I was like, I don't know why I don't want to get out of bed. I don't know why taking a shower feels like that's going to take me nearly 2 hours of sort of preparing myself mentally to do that. And I don't know why I feel so angry. And I don't know why I want to hurt the people that are closest to me. And I don't know why I want to hurt the people who I love the most and who love me. I couldn't connect it to the fact that I had been violated and that I had had like a part of me taken and that I was never going to get that part back. I couldn't connect those two. And I think I wanted to create a character with Sarah where she, I mean, it's totally different, you know, that it was, she had lost her mother and she had never really dealt with that, that because she was damaged, that she had this anger and that she inflicted that upon other people. And I really wanted I really wanted to do that in a really compassionate way. And it was actually really hard for me when, like, people really, yeah. when, you know, the, like, every single review was like, she's just such a bitch and she's just the worst person in the world. And I felt like, God, did I really fail the character? Did I not try and portray that in a way that felt realistic?
But I think that just shows more what's wrong with people's perceptions than what's wrong.
Well, I think
with
particularly for women, do you know that there is this sort of idea of like an unlikable female character is just almost impossible to kind of. So it was
just
really
make her any less worthy.
It was really challenging. And they're like, she's just this character. And I was like, oh Christ, better not.
Yeah, so I guess for you, that's kind of like, oh well, does that mean you need to be really nice and perfect to be accepted?
But I actually think I probably had come to a point in my life, and I suppose as well because I felt so far removed from that person, because I'd done so much work on myself, and because I had worked through so much of that anger, and that I was able to kind of say, look, damaged people lash out, like, it's, you know, like a cornered rat will attack, you know, it's that's kind of part of, I mean, not for everybody, but for a lot of people. And I think there's such a lack of understanding that when we have people who are suffering with mental health issues or with anxiety, with depression, or who have been through some sort of trauma, whether that's domestic violence or sexual violence, it's much easier for us to empathize with them if they are kind, or if they're crying, or if they're upset. But actually, if they're behaving in ways that are unpleasant, if they're behaving in ways that are angry or frustrated, or that they're pushing you away, or they're being really aggressive, it's actually very difficult to kind of find it in yourself to be compassionate, because you're like, I'm trying to help, and you feel they feel like you're pushing it away.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's again, I think, trying to get away from these ideas or these preconceptions that we have around the way that people should behave when they have mental illness, or they should behave when they've been the victim, or they're a survivor. That it's like there's a very broad spectrum of behavior under all of these umbrellas, and that we have to try and, I suppose, hold some sort of compassion and kindness, even though that can be really difficult.
Yeah,
you know?
No, it's such a good point. Yeah, it's absolutely, like, it's so much more easy to feel sorry for someone or be there for someone if they're, you know, like, anxiety is sometimes, I think, easier for people to take because it's like, oh, she's scared, more so than like depression, maybe, where you're just angry and down. It's like, just don't be that way, you know. So we still have, we've learned a lot, but there's a long way to go,
so much more, you know, because I think people still think with mental health issues that you could just get over it if you were strong enough.
Yeah.
And actually the thing is that people with mental health issues are probably some of the strongest people,
exactly.
You know, because you have to manage something that is so debilitating and go out in the world and exist and do your job and you know, interact with people and not allow it to completely derail.
It's like someone said to me, like, it's easy to feel good on a sunny day, but like try and like center yourself and feel okay in the middle of a shitstorm, you know. And that's what people who are dealing with mental health difficulties are doing. They're trying to steady their balance in a storm.
Yeah.
And someone who isn't going through that is, you know, it's easy to just walk through your day when the sun is shining, you know, to use that analogy. But Louise O'Neill, I have loved chatting to you.
That was so good. Oh. I was going to say, this was just such an excuse for us
hang out, basically. I know. I've got such my fill. I got to ask all my questions, and the rest of the world gets to be in it as well. So thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for giving me your time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The easiest way to access Owning It Real Time is to head to the link in the episode description or episode details, whatever you call them, show notes. You will find the link in there at the top. You can sign up right away for Owning It Real Time and access the full library of 10 situation-specific audio guides that will help you own your anxiety even more than you've ever done before.